This is World Watchers program, October the 19th, 1987. The number of the program is 828. And this evening I'm going to talk about war and some more Robinson Jeffers poetry and matters pertaining to war. In 1974, I wrote an article, "The SLA is the CIA," and I compared Ronald Reagan's use of terrorism that he was building up with Edwin Meese and Mr. Gufrida from the Federal Emergency Management. In those days, it was called the Garden Splicer plot. They had cooked up with a national network. And their plans, literally, to use terrorism, I believe, to just start World War III. The article sounded very dramatic because I said the kidnapping of Patty Hearst could be comparable someday to the shooting of Archduke Franz Ferdinand, the very act, the insane act that started World War I. Well, Ronald Reagan became president in 1980, November the 80th, he was elected president. Very few people that I knew in those 6 years believed that such a thing was hardly possible and wondered what in the heck I was writing and talking about. I was on the air all this time from 1971 when he was governor for three more years up through 74, and then as he worked his way into the White House. And as soon as he was in the White House, the subjects he concerned himself immediately were not the budget that he campaigned on to balance the budget, not problems with medical conditions or health plans or housing or transportation or education, but terrorism, the very thing that he was groomed on for 8 years and was groomed to put into place as the excuse for our eventually taking as many countries as we can before they planned World War III against the Soviet Union. So at his first meetings with Secretary of State Alexander Haig and the National Security Council, the subject was Libya, Iran, and then Nicaragua, getting the government out and putting in the Somoza government down in Nicaragua. And now we're getting closer to war with the pursuit in the Gulf. The minute we flagged those ships, we were halfway towards Reagan's idea of a good presidency. He often compared himself to Franklin Roosevelt. I've said this over and over, but I think the time is ripe to re-listen to those words and think of what I said. He had the illusion of being a commander-in-chief. He became that. Last week, he talked about the War Powers Act not interfering with him because he said, in quotes, "I am the commander-in-chief." And he also thought about Roosevelt's third term, where he was put in based upon the war that we couldn't change presidents at the time of the war. Well, now we have Ronald Reagan in a situation where he's literally backed against the wall. Wall Street Journal and other newspapers last week continued their articles on Reagan's impotence. We have his best friends, Michael Deaver, ready to be before a court of law, possibly prosecuted. Edwin Meese the same. Lynn Nofziger the same. He has a special prosecutor hanging in limbo. No prosecutions yet against his national security advisor, Admiral Poindexter, his best friend and identification expert, Oliver North, who's the great Rambo that Reagan never was, and he never went to war. He has the possible indictment of Oliver North. And then there's that secret team that's worked for this government the past years since the OSS and on up to the present. Albert Hakim, fairly new to the gang. Thomas Klein's an old-timer, 29 years with the CIA. Theodore Shackley, years with the CIA, John Singlaub with the OSS, and all those people are under investigation, are defendants in the Christic Institute suit, so that the very people around him, the people who raised the money for him, Carl Spitz Channel and Richard Miller, all of them are caught into a web, and combined the frustration of having all of his administration coming down, and at the same time, his ambition to lead us into war, and realize that flagging the Kuwaiti ships was one step closer towards that war. Now, deals are cut. I'm absolutely convinced long, long, long before the wars happen. If Iran hits back and we strike back and get into a major war in the Middle East and we don't know where it's going to lead, and this president is determined never to get out, to stay there so nothing but bad can happen with all those ships and weapons, these deals were cut a long time ago, and I believe that all of us are collectively responsible for watching these steps develop and sitting by and not seeing the significance as they took place. Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt in 1943 had held back any help for the Soviet Union until they saw that the Soviet Union could resist the Nazis, and then they came in and offered land troops, because then the Russians were coming west and they didn't want them to have too much influence over all of Europe. So at that point, they came in to help Russia, but Russia was only an ally in name only when they started to be victorious and when it was obvious that they were holding their own against Adolf Hitler. I always talk about the year 1943 or the years 43 to 45 when the seeds were planted for what we're experiencing now and what we are going to experience in the next few years. 43, when Fritz Kramer from Germany recruited Henry Kissinger into military intelligence to join him with top Nazis as soon as the war was over in 1945, when Alan Dulles was sent to head the OSS branch in Bern, Switzerland, to recruit the top Nazis of Heinrich Himmler's Gestapo for the next round, obviously for the next round. That's when William Stevenson of British intelligence moved into the USA to Rockefeller Center to set up our network to blend in with the British intelligence and the British ruling class that had some ideas about Russia as against Nazism, the mass of them favoring Nazism and getting us ready for that mindset in the years that followed. And along those lines of saying this preparation was done way, way back, there was an article this past week in the San Francisco Chronicle based on a new book coming out. The book's called The Nazi Hunters. The author is Chuck Ashman. The Chronicle article was October the 11th, 1987, titled The CIA Tells of Report on Kurt Waldheim. And the gist of the article is that the Central Intelligence Agency has now admitted that they've had access to a top-secret document that would throw the U.S. intelligence officers, that they knew, that would show that the U.S. intelligence officers knew before the end of World War II that Kurt Waldheim, with his activities in Greece and Yugoslavia and so forth, that he was involved in Nazi activities. The Chicago Sun-Times is reporting this story this past weekend. A newspaper in Vienna and a magazine disclosed for the first time in the September 4th issue that they quoted certain documents as saying that the Waldheim story shows involvement of him with American agencies before the war was over. Before the war was over, he was linked up to American agencies. The Sun-Times said that the CIA acknowledged there are OSS documents, but they remain top secret. Somebody was protecting Kurt Waldheim till he became the ambassador to the UN, the head of the UN, and then the president of Austria. And this book that is coming out in called The Nazi Hunters talks about the activities of Waldheim that were previously known from U.S. Army documents and the current story that he wasn't discovered as a Nazi until 1948 are now thrown out the window, just as the documentation on finding Eva Braun's teeth or Adolf Hitler's teeth or body. These stories through the years become changed as people surface and say, no, those stories weren't right. We lied about them. Now, this article in this book also referred to a man that I've had on, mentioned him on World Watchers two or three years ago. His name is Fritz Molden, M-O-L-D-E-N. He's a publisher of a Vienna newspaper called Die Presse. He's the son-in-law of the late CIA director, Alan Dulles, and he was instrumental in bringing Kurt Waldheim into the Austrian Foreign Ministry and managing his career after World War II until he came to the position of being the UN advisor and also then the president of Austria. Alan Dulles, again, who set up his offices in Bern, Switzerland, starting in 43, and then working with these top Nazis, and they've had many prominent positions. I'm sure this is as important as any, being the head of the UN and also the president of Austria. But it's important because this team of government agents, starting with William Sullivan also of the FBI, working with J. Edgar Hoover, set up operations to merge with Great Britain and incorporate these particular Nazis. And they've been in our government since before the war was over, May the 8th, 1945. Now, a long listener to World Watchers sent me some poetry because I was talking about Robinson Jeffers and his feelings about Franklin Roosevelt, comparing him to Adolf Hitler. So I want to share those with you tonight. There is a lot of important stories in the news, but nothing is more important than how wars begin and who is behind the wars and what comes from these wars, in lieu of the fact that we had a full approval of the Democrats and Republicans who were consulted by the president that it's okey-doke to start bombing away at Syrian bases. And this is both sides of the government that's called bipartisan agreement that the president is absolutely right in what he's doing in the Persian Gulf, which is very dangerous. So in lieu of the way wars start and what Robinson Jeffers was writing about in 1940, when the seeds of World War II were coming, and what Franklin Roosevelt was doing in 1940 are what I want to share with you, because not only was Robinson Jeffers talking about that from 40 to 43 in 1945, but he was predicting this war that we're going to get ourselves into. It became inevitable when he saw the people around Franklin Roosevelt that were setting the stage. Now, just coincidentally with the Robinson Jeffers broadcast I had several weeks ago and mentioned on the talk show part of the program, the San Francisco Chronicle has a review of a new book of Robinson Jeffers called Rock and Hawk, a selection of shorter poems by Robinson Jeffers. And the reviewer is Tom Clark, and he explains how Jeffers lived in Carmel and was isolated and withdrew from the world. He said that seeing around and beyond the human race, he preferred the rocks and kelp and buzzards, and he rejected modern society and politics and art and also the human race. This is what the reviewer is saying, because he called the human race, and this is true, a botched American species that has run wild and ought to be stopped. It's out of control. And he also said, on a positive sense, but it's never or hardly used enough, he said that Robinson Jeffers also believed that the human beings as a race could be saved if they only preserved what they are now destroying. The only way to save your race is to save the things that you are, in fact, destroying. And that's why he's so popular with the Save the Planet people in the ecology movement now, that what we're destroying is what is going to do away with the human race. And then in conclusion of the review of the book, The Rock and Hawk, this particular person says that Jefferson's poetry was written a long time ago, crusted with blood and barbaric omens, painful to the excess. But, he says, that's because the course of human events that so horrified Robinson Jeffers has ironically proven many of the darkest forecasts to be accurate. Now, what the artist many times see, not all artists, but many times do, or Jeffers saw, was that the course we took with World War I and rebuilding for World War II and the President Franklin Roosevelt was for America what Hitler was for Germany. That's pretty radical to think that. Now, what I want to do is just share some lines or two poems of Jeffers and some lines from his book, and then go to a speech that Franklin Roosevelt gave in 1937. And this is when Jeffers was writing his poetry that set the world, that told Hitler it's okay to rearm, you're on your own, that Roosevelt literally gave him the go-ahead. This speech was reprinted just this past week in the LA Herald by a professor at Rice University called The Speech That Gave Hitler the Go-Ahead, given by Franklin Delano Roosevelt in Chicago 50 years ago in 1937. Now, Jeffers has many, many poems, and I just want to read a few of lines and poems of his feelings about war. And as I say, then get to the historical period that he was writing it in. And for the historical record, well, I have many books on Roosevelt and that time era. I'm going to read from the newsletters of George Seldes. I consider him the greatest researcher of that time period, or practically of any of our time periods, the original or greatest muckraker. He's still alive today. And read what he was writing in his newsletter about Franklin Roosevelt at the same time Jeffers was writing the poetry. And it isn't something that pertains to way back then, 50 years ago or 45 years ago. It's us today on the brink of the Persian Gulf. Robinson Jeffers wrote a short poem called Next Armistice Day. It was written in 1942. That was right after Pearl Harbor, but before we got really heavily into the war, at least the European War, 1942. It said, finally, in white innocence, the fighter planes like swallows dance. The bombers above ruined towns will drop wreaths of roses down. Doves will nest in the guns' throats, and people will dance in the streets. This is 1942, and the armistice was in June 45, May 45, the German war ended, and in August of 45 in Japan. He said, on that great day, the boys will hang Hitler and Roosevelt on one tree, painlessly in effigy, to take their rank in history. Roosevelt and Hitler and Guy Fawkes, hanged above the garden walls, while the happy children cheer without hate, without fear, and new men plot the next war. And it was in 42 and 43 that George Seldes is talking about the plotting of the next war after this war, why we were getting into the war in Europe to keep our troops there permanently against socialism or the Soviet Union. And he wrote they were already plotting the new war, and indeed, Franklin Roosevelt was. He has another poem called Tragedy Has Its Obligations, which is an excellent one. But this is one that this listener sent to me, and I had Mark to share with you also. It's called Wilson. That's Woodrow Wilson, the president. Wilson in Hell. Roosevelt died and met Wilson, who said, in quotes, I blundered into it through honest error, and conscience cut me so deep that I died in the vain effort to prevent future wars. But you blew on the coal bed, and when it kindled, you deliberately sabotaged every firewall that even the men who denied my hope had built. You have too much murder on your hands. I will not speak of the lies and conniving. I cannot understand the mercy that permits us to meet in the same heaven. Or is this my hell? And that was written in March of 1944, a year and 2 months before the war was over. And one other poem that is controversial, these are controversial, is called Ethical Note. In Russia, 20 million Russians were deliberately starved to aggrandize the state, and at the moment, 10 million are slaves in camps. The ordinary citizen, the iron of the government across his face, is rapturously grateful to be allowed to walk in a park or attend church. And in England, fine freedom is built on conquest. England has robbed, enslaved, exterminated her sisters, holding she intends to hold what she has. France, Belgium, and Holland hope to reclaim their empires. America has robbed and exterminated the helpless tribes of the continent, and all her golden Southwest is war spoils. As I was saying, Germany, too, is guilty of war crimes. And where did Germany learn that? In the poem The Double Axe, he becomes very against war, and this was during the war, and he has, it's a long poem. I want to read just some lines of a person who comes back. He's dead, he's killed in war, and he comes back to his family, and the mother's surprised to see him. She says, my God, you're back again. You killed some Japs? Yeah. He said, no, I got killed, he said, gripping his mother's wrist. There are millions and millions, but as far as I know, I'm the only one that has come back. It's unbelievable. How can they lie so still after being gypped and killed? Gypped by their governments, by their fathers, by their women, gypped out of life, fooled and despised and lied to and stuck under the mangrove roots and the black mud, under the coral sand and the Russian snow and the cabbages in Europe. They're too submissive. They ought to damn patience and rise. Think of the stinking armies, the semi-skeletons marching on Washington, all those dead that have been killed. Here comes your war. And he was imitating Franklin Roosevelt's use of war. The president's manner of speech. Here is your war. You made it. How do you like it? Well, the German boys unfox the holes at Berchtesgaden garden, and the little killed nips nip their emperor to death. It would be fine. But he said, justice begins at home. So still they have their American Legion suppers. The poor old war hounds, the last Saturday of every month. What a life. I guess we don't lose much by dying young. It's the lies, it's the dirty lies, war peddler lies, and the people's imbecility that raked me out of the grave. By the way, Mother, keep my secret. Don't tell the old man I'm dead. I want to tease him a while. If any person begins to say, we have to save England, and here's our president telling us what we have to do right now in the Gulf. If any president begins to say, we have to save England or rescue France or avenge the Jews, take him and hang him. He's pimping for war. If he says democracy, remember they pimp for war, they will rise again. Take him and hang him. Or if he says we must save civilization, they said it before, take him up and hang him. If they say it's my country, right or wrong, they are pimping for war, take them up and hang them higher than Haman. Hell, we've had a fine orchard when the sun ripes the plums. You'll be there, old man, he went on to say, right along with the president, his old man being his father, right along with the president and his paid mouths and the radio shouters and the writers and the world planners and the heavy bishops and the England lovers and the little poets and the college professors, the seducers of boys, the pimps of death, the pimps stretched all in a row, swing high, swing low. And then he goes on, and they say, what have you done? She turned when he came closer to her and said, your eyes don't shine. It's horrible to hate so much and hate and go over their reasons again. And they have no reason to condemn me to death. And she wants to know about what he's thinking. And he says, well, we rotted in Schofield Barracks while we were sold to death by liars and fools. There is nothing left but to envy and degrade life with our stinking bodies and betrayed minds. I have had joy and freedom sometimes as beautiful as you, Mother, and loved her, referring to somebody he cared for. But who cares? They pushed me down out of the sunlight, out of the decent air, into the dirt and the darkness. I fought back. I am only a bitter will holding up a corpse that walks and hates, even you, Mother. I wish I were back under the damned white crosses between the bush and the seas. They stole my life. I think I might have flowered clean, even to the floor of the cup. My death is not clean, and I haven't told you the half of it. This is a world grown monstrous, rabies-bitten, a nightmare false where millions of men were sacrificed for no reason but vanity. Thousands of ships and great fleets of planes with crammed wombs day and night labor over the farthest oceans to debark death, not on armies only, but old women and babies and little dogs, and the worst is coming. Don't say freedom is for foreigners, unless you intend to kill Russia on top of Germany, Britain on Japan, churn the whole world into one bloody bubble bath. Don't say democracy. Don't talk that much and mush, and don't pretend that the world will be improved or goodwill earned or peace made perfect by blasting cities and nations into bloody choppets. If you believe that, you believe anything. They are lockable madhouses for fools to simper and howl in while the whole planet's one. And then in this particular poem, he has two more statements here. You needn't be sorry for me. I and you will have a settling. By sorry for the decent and loyal people of America, caught by their own loyalty, fouled, gouged, and bled to feed the power-hungry politicians and make trick fortunes for swindlers and collaborators. For a time is coming, fairly soon, you'll not see it, when the ends of the earth from east and west, one world, will close on your country for allowing this. Like the jaws of a trap, he said, people will say, be quiet, we were fooled before. We know all governments are thugs and liars. Let them fight their own battles. The trap is closing, and an angry spirit will go through the camps, whispering mutiny in conscripts' ears. Your rulers are cooking another world war. And this is written in the 42. Come and we'll kill them, and the spirit will be mine. It will scream like an eagle over the mountains, the quisling cities and burning cities, sabotaged airfields, while the enemy makes good his beachheads. But who knows that submission is better than war, he asks. I don't know. I don't know. And then he talks, as I say, about the decent and loyal people of America in that poem. And he also refers in one poem called Mitching Malecho, which is based after a drama in Hamlet, The Murder of Gonzago, where he refers to, and this is so important, the mischief of the old people over the young. And he begins by saying, wagging their hoary heads, glaring through their bright spectacles, old gentlemen shout for war, while youth, amazed and unwilling and submissive, watch them. And it's not normal. It's really ominous, and it's good comedy. But for a coming time, it means mischief, for the boys have memories. And what he is saying, he's warning of the future, because there's a close relationship between old gentlemen, grandfathers, and elderly fathers who remember war, and young boys who are submissive, they're idealistic, they are thinking of all the happy things that childhood has. But then the time comes when the youth is persuaded to war, and he says it's a tragic occurrence, ominous of more bloodshed, because you are victimized by youth, which is not normal, because boys have memories. And all of a sudden, to protect your country or your religion or your area, your piece of geography, you remember what grandpa said and what father said, and then the little boy turns into a man, and then the problems begin. And he predicts that this perpetuates the war, because while you're silent and you listen, and the president again has those paid mouths, he's the seducer of boys, the pimps of death, that little young people are not told about the peaceful people, the people trying to make peace, but they're fed the stories of war. Now, as I mentioned before, this San Francisco LA Herald had an article beginning in Chicago 50 years ago today, and it's about Franklin Roosevelt giving a speech in 1937 in which he made it quite clear that he would not oppose Adolf Hitler in Germany. He may slap the wrist of the Japan going into Manchuria, but the person who wrote this article, Francis Lowenhun, is a professor of history at Rice University, and he said it was clear by this speech in 1937 that the president's outburst in Chicago was directed against Japan, and assuming that there would not be any confrontation in Germany. The Chicago fanfare turned in a call to retreat, with the bad word quarantine no longer mentioned anywhere, and there were no indications that the United States intended to intervene actively in the Far Eastern conflict, let alone in the European conflict. Roosevelt gave this very important speech at that time. And in this article, he's compared to Woodrow Wilson, again, the person that Robinson Jeffers wrote about. And the article says, at home and abroad, public and political opinions seemed distinctly favorable to what Roosevelt was saying. But it goes on to say that even the Chicago Tribune briefly moderated its usual harsh anti-Roosevelt position and said the moment came, it editorialized, when Woodrow Wilson found himself with no alternative for war. Does not Mr. Roosevelt's policy invite the coming of the day when he, too, may have no alternative but to resort to arms? That while Wilson didn't have an alternative and caught him by surprise, he said, I had no alternative. I didn't know what was happening. That Franklin Roosevelt will have no alternative, that even though he thinks he's taking the right choice in that controversial speech, he was giving the green light to Hitler. And the article concludes by saying, November the 5th, 1947, at the Reich Chancellery in Berlin, Hitler assembled the military chiefs at a four-hour top-secret meeting and unveiled to them his grand design for the mastery of Europe. Unknown to all but a few Nazi insiders, Europe and America were formally launched on the road to World War II, and Roosevelt was taking a stance that gave Hitler the green light until we entered the theater there in Europe many years later. This was 1937, and our troops landed later. Now, I'll take a one-minute break in this particular part of the broadcast and go into what was happening in the United States with Franklin Roosevelt when Robinson Jeffers was writing his poetry. Now, for those of you who are interested, there are a lot of good books. John Dodson, who's on Kazoo and reads poetry, is one of the foremost experts on Robinson Jeffers. And his book that I got at the festival, the Jeffers Festival, has a chronological order of Robinson Jeffers' life. And if you take some of the books that are out and see where he lived and his education, he's probably one of the best educated Americans that ever happened to be living in this country, and he settled in Carmel. I'll take a one-minute break from that subject and remind you that it's your turn at the end of this next half hour to call 375-3082.